through sheer exhaustion, waking up every time there was a sound outside. My dreams a vivid, crazy quilt of blood and fire and water. It was midday before we heard the sound of voices approaching. My heart leapt as I recognized one of them, and Jamie was on his feet before the door flap lifted.
"Ian, is that you?"
"Aye, Uncle. It's me."
His voice sounded odd, breathless and uncertain. He stepped into the light from the smoke hole, and I gasped, feeling as though I had been punched in the stomach. The hair had been plucked from the sides of his skull. What was left stood up in a thick crest from his scalp, a long tail hanging down his back. One ear had been freshly pierced and sported a silver earring. His face had been tattooed, double crescent lines of small dark spots, most still scabbed with dried blood, ran across each cheekbone to meet at the bridge of his nose.
"I canna stay long, Uncle," Ian said.
He looked pale under the lines of tattooing, but stood erect.
"I said they must let me come to say goodbye."
Jamie had gone white to the lips.
"Jesus, Ian," he whispered.
"The naming ceremony is tonight," Ian said, trying not to look at us.
"They say after that, I will be Indian. And I must not speak any tongue but the Kanyan Kayaka. I canna speak again in English or the Gaelic."
He smiled painfully.
"And I ken ye dinna have much Mohawk. Ian, ye canna be doing this."
"I've done it, Uncle Jamie," Ian said softly.
He looked at me then.
"Auntie, will you say to my mother that I will na forget her? My da will know, I think."
"Oh, Ian." I hugged him hard, and his arms went gently around me.
"You can leave in the morning," he said to Jamie. "They will not prevent you."
I let him go, and he crossed the hut to where Roger stood, looking stunned. Ian offered him a hand.
"I'm sorry for what we did to you," he said quietly. "You'll take good care of my cousin and the bairn."
Roger took his hand and shook it. He cleared his throat and found his voice.
"I will," he said. "I promise."
Then Ian turned to Jamie.
"No, Ian," he said. "God, no, lad. Let it be me."
Ian smiled, though his eyes were full of tears.
"You said to me once that my life wasn't meant to be wasted," he said. "It won't be."
He held out his arms.
"I will not forget you either, Uncle Jamie."
They took Ian to the bank of the river just before sunset. He stripped and waded into the freezing water, accompanied by three women who ducked and pummeled him, laughing and scrubbing him with handfuls of sand. Rollo ran up and down the bank, barking madly, then plunged into the river and joined in what he plainly saw as fun and games, coming close to drowning Ian in the process. All of the spectators who lined the bank found it hilarious, save the three whites. Once the white blood had been thus ceremonially scrubbed from Ian's body, more women dried him, dressed him in fresh clothing, and took him to the council longhouse for the naming ceremony. Everyone crowded inside. All of the village was there. Jamie, Roger, and I stood silently in a corner, watching as the sachem sang and spoke over him, as the drums beat, as the pipe was lit and passed from hand to hand. The girl he called Emily stood near him, eyes shining as she looked at him. I saw him look back at her, and the light that sprang up in his own eyes did a little to ease the soreness of my heart. They called him Wolf's brother. His brother Wolf sat panting at Jamie's feet, viewing the proceedings with interest. At the end of the ceremony, a small hush fell on the crowd, and at that moment Jamie stepped out of the corner. All heads turned as he crossed to Ian, and I saw more than one warrior tense in disapproval. He unpinned the brooch from his plaid, unbelted it, and laid the length of blood-stained crimson tartan across his nephew's shoulder.
"Remember,"
he said softly, and stepped back. All of us were quiet as we made our way down the narrow trail that led away from the village next morning. Ian had taken a formal, white-faced farewell of us as he stood with his new family. I hadn't been so stalwart, though, and seeing my tears made Ian bite his lip to hold back his own emotion. Jamie had embraced him, kissed his mouth, and left him without speaking a word. Jamie went about the business of setting camp that night with his usual efficiency, but I could tell that his mind was somewhere else. And no wonder if it was. My own was divided in worry between Ian behind us and Brianna ahead of us, with very little attention to spare for present circumstances. Roger dumped an armload of wood beside the fire and sat down next to me.
"I've been thinking," he said quietly, "about Brianna."
"Have you?" "So have I." I was so tired I thought I might tumble headfirst into the flames before I got the water boiling.
"You said there was another circle, opening, whatever it is, in the Indies."
"Yes." I thought briefly of telling him all about Geely Duncan and the cave at Abandawi, and dismissed it. I hadn't the energy. Another time. Then I jerked out of my mental fog, catching what he was saying. "Another one? Here?" I looked wildly around as though expecting to see a Menhir standing menacingly at my back.
"Not here," he said. "Somewhere between here and Fraser's Ridgel."
"Oh." I tried to gather my scattered thoughts. "Yes, I know there is, but..." Then it penetrated, and I grabbed his arm. "You mean you know where it is?"
"You knew about it?"
He stared at me in astonishment. "Yes, I..." "Here, look." I scrabbled in my pouch and came up with the opal. He grabbed it from me before I could explain.
"Look, it's the same symbol. It's carved on the rock in the circle. Where the hell did you get this?"
"It's a long story," I said. "I'll tell you later. But for now, do you know where this circle is? You've actually seen it?" Jamie, attracted by our excitement, had come to see what was going on.
"A circle?
A time circle, an opening,
"I've been there,"
Roger said, interrupting my stuttering explanations.
"I found it by accident while I was trying to escape."
"Could you find it again? How far is it from River Run?" My mind was making frantic calculations. A little more than 7 months. If it took 6 weeks to return, Brianna would be 8.5 months gone. Could we possibly take her into the mountains in time? And if we could, what would be the greater risk? To travel through a time passage on the verge of delivery, or to stay in the past permanently? Roger dug in the waistband of his ragged breeches and brought out a strand of thread, grimy and knotted.
"Here," he said, grasping a double knot. "It was 8 days past the day that they took me. 8 days from Fraser's Ridge.
And a week, at least, from River Run to the ridge." I let myself breathe again, not sure whether I felt disappointment or relief. "We'd never make it."
"But the weather is turning," Jamie said.
He nodded toward a big blue spruce, its needles wet and dripping.
"When we came, that tree was cased in ice."
He looked at me.
"The travelling may be easier. We may make better time. Or not."
"Or not." I shook my head reluctantly. "You know as well as I do that spring means mud, and mud is worse to travel in than snow." I felt my heart begin to slow down, accepting it. "No, it's too late, too risky. She'll have to stay." Jamie was gazing at Roger over the fire.
"He doesn't," he said.
Roger looked at him, startled.
"I..." he began,
then firmed his jaw and started over.
"I do. You don't think I'd leave her? And my child?"
I opened my mouth and felt Jamie stiffen beside me in warning. "No," I said sharply. "No. We have to tell him. Brianna will. Better he should know now. If it makes a difference to him, then it's better he knows before he sees her." Jamie's lips pressed tight together, but he nodded.
"Aye," he said. "Tell him, then. Tell me what?
Roger's dark hair was loose, rising round his head in the evening wind. He looked more alive than he had since we had found him, alarmed and excited at once.
I bit the bullet.
It may not be your child, I said. His expression didn't change for a moment. Then the words fell into place. He grabbed me by the arm so suddenly that I yelped with alarm.
What do you mean? What's happened?
Jamie moved like a striking snake. He caught Roger a short, sharp blow under the chin that loosened his grip and sent him sprawling backward on the ground.
She means that when you left my daughter to her own devices, she was raped, he said roughly. 2 days past the time you lay with her. So maybe the wane's yours, and maybe it's not.
He glared down at Roger.
So, do you mean to stand by her, or no?
Roger shook his head, trying to clear it, and got slowly back to his feet.
Raped? Who? Where? In Wilmington. A man named Stephen Bonnet. He... Bonnet!
It was only too clear from Roger's expression that the name was familiar. He stared wildly from me to Jamie and back.
Brianna was raped by Stephen Bonnet. So I said.
Suddenly, all the rage Jamie had been holding since our exit from the village broke loose. He seized Roger by the throat and slammed him into a tree trunk.
And where were you when it was done, you coward? She was angry with you, and so you ran away and left her. If you thought you must go, why did you not see her safe into my keeping first?
I grabbed Jamie's arm and yanked. Let go of him! He did, and whirled away, breathing hard. Roger, shaken and almost as furious as Jamie, shook down his ruffled clothing.
I didn't leave because we argued. I left to find this.
He snatched a handful of his loose breeches and ripped at the cloth. A spark of green brightness glowed in the palm of his hand.
I risked my life to get that, to see her safe back through the stones. Do you know where I went to get it? Who I got it from? Stephen Bonnet. That's why it took me so long to come to Fraser's Ridge. He wasn't where I expected him to be. I had to ride up and down the coast to find him.
Jamie was frozen, staring at the gemstone. So was I.
I shipped with Stephen Bonnet from Scotland.
Roger was growing a little calmer.
He's a kin what he is.
Jamie stirred, breaking his trance.
But what he also may be is the father of my daughter's child.
He gave Roger a long, cold look.
So, I'm asking you, Mackenzie, can you go back to her and live with her, knowing that it's likely Bonnet's child she bears? For if you canna do it, then say so now. For I swear, if you come to her and treat her badly, I will kill you without a second thought.
For God's sake, I burst out. Give him a moment to think, Jamie. Can't you see that he hasn't had a chance even to take it in yet? Roger's fist closed tight over the jewel, then opened. I could hear him breathing, harsh and ragged.
I don't know, he said. I don't know.
Jamie stooped and picked up the stone where Roger had dropped it. He flung it hard between Roger's feet.
Then go, he said. Take yon cursed stone and find your wicked circle. Get ye gone, for my daughter doesna need a coward.
He hadn't yet unsaddled the horses. He seized his saddlebags and heaved them across the horse's back. He untied both his horse and mine, and mounted in one fluid motion.
Come,
he said to me. I looked helplessly at Roger. He was staring up at Jamie, green eyes glinting with firelight, bright as the emerald in his hand.
Go,
he said softly to me, not taking his eyes off Jamie.
If I can, then I'll come.
My hands and feet seemed not to belong to me. They moved smoothly without my direction. I walked to my horse, put my foot in the stirrup, and was up. When I looked back, even the light of the fire had disappeared. There was nothing behind us but the dark. Chapter 62. 3/3 of a Ghost. River Run, April 1770.
They have captured Stephen Bonnet.
Brianna dropped the game box on the floor. Ivory counters exploded in every direction. She stood staring at Lord John, who set down his glass of brandy and came hastily to her side.
Are you all right? Do you require to sit down? I apologize most profoundly. I should not have...
Yes, you should. No, not the sofa. I'll never get out of it. She waved away his offered hand and made her way slowly toward a plain wooden chair near the windows.
Once solidly on it, she gave him a long, level look.
Where? She said. How?
He didn't trouble asking whether he ought to send for wine or burnt feathers. She plainly wasn't going to swoon.
He drew up a stool beside her, but then thought better, and went to the parlour door.
He glanced out into the dark hallway. Sure enough, one of the maids was dozing on a stool in the curve of the staircase, available in case they should want anything. The woman's head snapped up at his step, eyes showing white in the dimness. "Go to bed," he said. "We shall not require anything further this evening."
The slave nodded and shuffled off, relief in the droop of her shoulders. She would have been awake since dawn, and it was near midnight now. He was desperately tired himself after the long ride from Edenton, but it wasn't news that could wait. He had arrived in the early evening, but this had been his first opportunity to make an excuse to see Brianna alone. He closed the double doors and placed a footstool in front of them to prevent any interruptions.
"He was taken here in Cross Creek," he said, without preamble, sitting down beside her. "As to how, I could not say. The charge brought was smuggling. Once they discovered his identity, of course, there were others added."
"Smuggling what?"
"Tea and brandy. At least this time."
He rubbed the back of his neck, trying to relieve the stiffness caused by hours in the saddle.
"I heard of it in Edenton. Evidently the man is notorious. His reputation extends from Charleston to Jamestown."
He looked closely at her. She was pale, but not ghastly.
"He is condemned," he said quietly. "He will hang next week in Wilmington. I thought you would wish to know."
She took a deep breath and let it out slowly, but said nothing. He stole a closer look at her, not wanting to stare, but amazed at the sheer size of her. By God, she was immense. In the 2 months since their engagement, she had doubled in size, at least. One side of her enormous abdomen bulged suddenly out, startling him. He was having second thoughts about the wisdom of having told her. If the shock of his news brought on her confinement prematurely, he would never forgive himself. Jamie wouldn't forgive him either. She was staring off into space, her brow wrinkled in concentration. He'd seen brood mares in foal look that way, thoroughly absorbed in inward matters. It had been a mistake to send the slave away. He got his feet under him, meaning to go and fetch assistance, but the movement brought her out of her trance. "Thank you," she said. The frown was still there, but her eyes had lost that distant look. They were fixed on him with a disconcerting blue directness. The more disconcerting for being so familiar. "When will they hang him?" She leaned forward a little, hand pressed against her side. Another swell rippled across her belly in apparent response to the pressure. He sat back, eyeing her stomach uneasily.
"Friday week."
"Is he in Wilmington now?" Slightly reassured by her calm demeanour, he reached for his abandoned glass. He took a sip and shook his head, feeling the comfort of the warm liquor spread through his chest.
"No, he is still here. There was no need for trial, as he had been previously convicted."
"So they'll move him to Wilmington for the execution? When?"
"I have no idea."
The distant look was back. With deep misgiving, he recognized it this time. Not motherly abstraction, calculation. "I want to see him." Very deliberately, he swallowed the rest of the brandy.
No, he said definitely, setting down the glass. Even if your state allowed of travel to Wilmington, which it assuredly does not, he added, glancing sidelong at her dangerous-looking abdomen, attendance at an execution could not but have the worst effects upon your child. Now I'm in complete sympathy with your feelings, my dear, but...
No, you aren't. You don't know what my feelings are. She spoke without heat, but with complete conviction. He stared at her for a moment, then got up and went to fetch the decanter. She watched the amber liquid purl up in the glass and waited for him to pick it up before she went on. "I don't want to watch him die," she said.
"Thank God for that,"
he muttered, and took a mouthful of brandy. "I want to talk to him." The mouthful went down the wrong way, and he choked, spluttering brandy over the frills of his shirt. "Maybe you should sit down," she said, squinting at him. "You don't look so good."
I can't think why.
Nonetheless, he sat down and groped for a kerchief to wipe his face. Now, I know what you're going to say, she said firmly, so don't bother. Can you arrange for me to see him before they take him to Wilmington? And before you say no, certainly not, ask yourself what I'll do if you do say that.
Having opened his mouth to say no, certainly not, Lord John shut it and contemplated her in silence for a moment. "I don't suppose you are intending to threaten me again, are you?"
he asked conversationally.
"Because if you are—"
"Of course not." She had the grace to blush slightly at that.
"Well, then, I confess I do not see quite what you—"
"I'll tell my aunt that Stephen Bonnet fathered my baby. And I'll tell Farquhar Campbell and Gerald Forbes— and Judge Alderdice. And then I'll go down to the garrison headquarters. That must be where he is. And I'll tell Sergeant Murchison. If he won't let me in, I'll go to Mr. Campbell for a writ to make him admit me. I have a right to see him." He looked at her narrowly, but he could see it was no idle threat. She sat there, solid and immobile as a piece of marble statuary, and just as susceptible of persuasion.
"You do not shrink from creating a monstrous scandal."
It was a rhetorical question. He sought only to buy himself a moment to think. "No," she said calmly. "What have I got to lose?" She lifted one eyebrow in a half-humorous quirk. "I suppose you'd have to break our engagement. But if the whole county knows who the baby's father is, I think that would have the same effect as the engagement, in terms of keeping men from wanting to marry me."
"Your reputation," he began,
knowing it was hopeless, "is not real hot to start with. Though, come to that, why should it be worse for me to be pregnant because I was raped by a pirate than because I was wanton, as my father so charmingly put it?" There was a small note of bitterness in her voice that stopped him from saying any more. "Anyway, Aunt Jocasta isn't likely to throw me out just because I'm scandalous. I won't starve, neither will the baby. And I can't say I care whether the Mrs. McNeil call on me or not." He took up his glass and drank again, carefully this time, with an eye on her to prevent further shocks. He was curious to know what had passed between her and her father, but not reckless enough to ask. Instead, he put down the glass and asked,
"Why?"
"Why?"
"Why do you feel you must speak with Bonnet? You say I do not know your feelings, which is undeniably true."
He allowed a tinge of wryness to creep into his voice.
"Whatever they are, though, they must be exigent to cause you to contemplate such drastic expedients."
A slow smile grew on her lips, spreading into her eyes. "I really like the way you talk," she said.
"I am exceeding flattered. However, if you would contemplate answering my question—"
She sighed, deeply enough to make the flame of the candle flicker. She stood up, moving ponderously, and groped in the seam of her gown. She had evidently had a pocket sewn into it, for she extracted a small piece of paper, folded and worn with much handling. Read that, she said, handing it to him. She turned away and went to the far end of the room, where her paints and easel stood in a corner by the hearth. The black letters struck him with a small jolt of familiarity. He had seen Jamie Fraser's hand only once before, but once was enough. It was a distinctive scrawl.
Daughter, I cannot say if I shall see you again. My fervent hope is that it shall be so, and that all may be mended between us. But that event must rest in the hand of God. I write now in the event that he may will otherwise. You asked me once whether it was right to kill in revenge of the great wrong done you. I tell you that you must not. For the sake of your soul, for the sake of your own life, you must find the grace of forgiveness. Freedom is hard won, but it is not the fruit of murder. Do not fear that he will escape vengeance. Such a man carries with him the seeds of his own destruction. If he does not die at my hand, it will be by another. But it must not be your hand that strikes him down. Hear me, for the sake of the love I bear you.
Below the text of the letter he had written, Your most affectionate and loving father, James Fraser. This was scratched out, and below it was written simply, Da.
I never said goodbye to him.
Lord John looked up, startled. Her back was turned to him. She was staring at the half-finished landscape on the easel as though it were a window. He crossed the carpet to stand beside her. The fire had burned down in the hearth, and it was growing cold in the room. She turned to face him, clutching her elbows against the chill. "I want to be free," she said quietly. "Whether Roger comes back or not, whatever happens." The child was restless. He could see it kicking and squirming below her crossed arms like a cat in a sack. He drew a deep breath, feeling chilled and apprehensive.
"You are sure you must see Bonnet?"
She gave him another of those long blue looks.
"I have to find a way to forgive him," Dar says. "I've been trying ever since they left, but I can't do it. Maybe if I see him I can. I have to try."
"All right."
He let his breath out in a long sigh, shoulders slumping in capitulation. A small light relief showed in her eyes, and he tried to smile back.
"You'll do it?"
"Yes. God knows how, but I'll do it."
He put out all the candles save one, keeping that to light their way to bed. He gave her his arm, and they walked in silence through the empty hall, the unpeopled quiet wrapping them in peace. At the foot of the stair he paused, letting her go ahead of him.
"Brianna."
She turned, questioning, on the stair above him. He stood hesitant, not knowing how to ask for what he suddenly wanted so badly. He reached out a hand, lightly poised.
"May I..."
Without speaking, she took his hand and pressed it against her belly. It was warm and very firm. They stood quite still for a moment, her hand locked over his. Then it came, a small hard push against his hand, which sent a thrill through his heart.
"My God," he said in soft delight, "he's real."
Her eyes met his in rueful amusement.
"Yes," she said. "I know."
It was well past dark when they drove up beside the garrison headquarters. It was a small, unprepossessing little building, dwarfed by the loom of the warehouse behind it, and Brianna eyed it askance.
"They have him in there?"
Her hands felt cold, in spite of being muffled under her cloak.
"No."
Lord John glanced around as he got down to tie the horses. A light burned in the window, but the small dirt yard was empty, the narrow street silent and deserted. There were no houses or shops nearby, and the warehousemen had long since gone home to their suppers and their beds. He reached up both hands to help her down, Alighting from a wagon was easier than getting out of a carriage, but still no small task.
"He's in the cellar below the warehouse," he told her, his voice pitched low. "I've bribed the soldier on duty to admit us."
"Not us," she said, her voice pitched as low as his, but no less firm for that. "Me. I'll see him alone." She saw his lips compress tightly for a moment, then relax as he nodded.
"Private Hodgepyle assures me he is in chains, or I would not countenance such a suggestion. As it is."
He shrugged, half irritably, and took her arm to guide her over the rutted ground.
"Hodgepyle?"
"Private Arvin Hodgepyle. Why? Are you acquainted?"
She shook her head, holding her skirts out of the way with her free hand. "No. I've heard the name, but..." The door of the building opened, spilling light into the yard.
"That'll be you, will it, my lord?"
A soldier looked out warily. Hodgepyle was slight and narrow-faced, tight-jointed as a marionette. He jerked, startled, as he saw her.
"Oh, I didn't realize..."
"You needn't." Lord John's voice was cool.
"Show us the way, if you please."
With an apprehensive glance at Brianna's looming bulk, the private brought out a lantern and led them to a small side door into the warehouse. Hodgepyle was short as well as slight, but held himself more erect than usual in compensation.
"He walks with a ramrod up his arse."
"Yes," she thought, watching him with interest as he marched ahead of them.
It had to be the man Ronnie Sinclair had described to her mother. How many Hodgepyles could there be, after all? Perhaps she could talk to him when she'd finished with...
Her thoughts stopped abruptly as Hodgepyle unlocked the warehouse door. The April night was cool and fresh, but the air inside was thick with the reek of pitch and turpentine. Brianna felt suffocated. She could almost feel the tiny molecules of resin floating in the air, sticking to her skin. The sudden illusion of being trapped in a block of solidifying amber was so oppressive that she moved suddenly forward, almost dragging Lord John with her. The warehouse was nearly full, its vast space crowded with bulky shapes. Kegs of pitch bled sticky black in the farthest shadows, while wooden racks near the huge double doors at the front held piles of barrels, brandy and rum, ready to roll down the ramps and out onto the dock to barges waiting in the river below. Private Hodgepyle's shadow stretched and shrank by turns as he passed between the towering ranks of casks and boxes, his steps muffled by the thick layer of sawdust on the floor.
"Must be careful of fire."
His high, thin voice floated back to her, and she saw his puppet shadow wave an etiolated hand.
"You will be careful where you set the lantern, won't you? Though there should be no danger, no danger at all down below."
The warehouse was built out over the river to facilitate loading, and the front part of the floor was wood. The back half of the building was brick-floored. Brianna heard the echo of their footsteps change as they crossed the boundary. Hodgepyle paused by a trap-door set into the bricks.
"You won't be long, my lord."
"No longer than we can help," Lord John replied tersely.
He took the lantern and waited in silence as Hodgepyle heaved up the door and propped it. Brianna's heart was beating heavily. She could feel each separate thump like a blow to the chest. A flight of red brick stairs ran down into darkness. Hodgepyle took out his ring of keys and counted them over in the pool of lantern light, making sure of the right one before descending. He squinted dubiously at Brianna, then motioned them to follow him.
"It's a good thing they made the stairs wide enough for rum casks," she murmured to Lord John, holding onto his arm as she edged herself down, one step at a time.
She could see at once why Private Hodgepyle wasn't worried about fire down here. The air was so damp she wouldn't have been surprised to see mushrooms sprouting from the walls. There was a sound of dripping water somewhere, and the light of the lantern shone off wet brick. Cockroaches scattered in panic from the light, and the air smelled of mould and mildew. She thought briefly of her mother's penicillin farm, less briefly of her mother, and her throat closed tight. Then they were there, and she could no longer distract herself from the realization of what she was doing. Hodgepyle struggled with the key, and the panic she had been suppressing all day swept over her. She had no idea what to say, what to do. What was she doing here? Lord John squeezed her arm in encouragement. She took a deep breath of the dank, wet air, ducked her head, and stepped inside. He sat on a bench at the far side of the cell, eyes fixed on the door. He'd clearly been expecting someone. He'd heard the footsteps outside, but it wasn't her. He jerked in startlement, and his eyes flashed briefly green as the light swept over him. She heard a faint metallic clink. Of course, they'd said he was in chains. The thought gave her a little courage. She took the lantern from Hodgepyle and shut the door behind her. She leaned against the wooden door, studying him in silence. He seemed smaller than she remembered. Perhaps it was only that she was now so much bigger. "Do you know who I am?" It was a tiny cell, low-ceilinged, with no echo. Her voice sounded small, but clear. He cocked his head to one side, considering. His eyes travelled slowly over her. "I don't think you were after telling me your name, sweetheart." "Don't call me that!" The spurt of rage took her by surprise, and she choked it back, clenching her fists behind her. If she had come here to administer forgiveness, it wasn't a good start. He shrugged, good-natured but cool. "As you will. No, I don't know who you are. I'll know your face, and a few other things." His teeth gleamed briefly in the blonde stubble of his beard. "But not your name. I suppose you'll mean to tell me, though."
"You do recognize me?"
He drew in air and blew it out through pursed lips, looking her over carefully. He was a good bit the worse for wear, but it hadn't impaired his assurance.
"Oh, indeed I do."
He seemed amused, and she wanted to cross the room and slap him hard. Instead, she took a deep breath. That was a mistake. She could smell him. Without warning, her gorge rose suddenly and violently. She hadn't been sick before, but the stench of him brought up everything in her. She had barely time to turn away before the flood of bile and half-digested food came hurtling up, splattering the damp brick floor. She leaned her forehead against the wall, waves of hot and cold running over her. Finally, she wiped her mouth and turned around. He was still sitting there, watching her. She'd set the lantern on the floor. It threw a yellow flicker upward, carving his face from the shadows behind him. He might have been a beast chained in its den. Only wariness showed in the pale green eyes. "My name is Brianna Fraser." He nodded, repeating it.
"Brianna Fraser. A lovely name, sure."
He smiled briefly, lips together. "And?"
"My parents are James and Claire Fraser. They saved your life and you robbed them."
"Yes."
He said it with complete matter-of-factness, and she stared at him. He stared back. She felt a wild urge to laugh, as unexpected as a surge of nausea had been. What had she expected? Remorse? Excuses? From a man who took things because he wanted them.
"If you've come in the hopes of getting back the jewels, I'm afraid you've left it too late," he said pleasantly. "I sold the first to buy a ship, and the other two were stolen from me. Perhaps you'll find that justice. I should think it cold comfort myself."
She swallowed, tasting bile.
"Stolen? When?"
"Don't trouble yourself over the man who's got it," Roger had said. "It's odds on he stole it from someone else."
Bonnet shifted on the wooden bench and shrugged.
"Some 4 months gone. Why?"
"No reason."
So Roger had made it. Had got them. The gems that might have been safe transport for them both. Cold comfort.
"I recall there was a trinket, too. A ring, was it? But you got that back."
He smiled, showing his teeth this time.
"I paid for it."
One hand went unthinking to her belly, gone round and tight as a basketball under her cloak. His gaze stayed on her face, curious.
"Have we business still to do, then, darling?"
She took a deep breath, through her mouth this time. "They told me you're going to hang."
"They told me the same thing."
He shifted again on the hard wooden bench. He stretched his head to one side to ease the muscles of his neck and peered up sidelong at her.
"You'll not have come from pity, though, I shouldn't think."
"No," she said, watching him thoughtfully. "To be honest, I'll rest a lot easier once you're dead." He stared at her for a moment, then burst out laughing. He laughed hard enough that tears came to his eyes. He wiped them carelessly, bending his head to swipe his face against a shrugged shoulder, then straightened up, the marks of his laughter still on his face.
"What is it you want from me, then?"
She opened her mouth to reply, and quite suddenly the link between them dissolved. She hadn't moved, but felt as though she had taken one step across an impassable abyss. She stood now safe on the other side, alone, blessedly alone. He could no longer touch her. "Nothing," she said, her voice clear in her own ears. "I don't want anything at all from you. I came to give you something." She opened her cloak and ran her hands over the swell of her abdomen. The small inhabitant stretched and rolled, its touch a blind caress of hand and womb, both intimate and abstract. "Yours," she said. He looked at the bulge and then at her.
"I've had whores try to foist their spawn on me before," he said.
But he spoke without viciousness, and she thought there was a new stillness behind the wary eyes. "Do you think I'm a whore?"
She didn't care if he did or not, though she doubted he did.
"I've no reason to lie. I already told you. I don't want anything from you." She drew the cloak back together, covering herself. She drew herself up then, feeling the ache in her back ease with the movement. It was done. She was ready to go. "You're going to die," she said to him. And she, who hadn't come for pity's sake, was surprised to find she had some. "If it makes the dying easier for you, to know there's something of you left on earth, then you're welcome to the knowledge. But I've finished with you now." She turned to pick up the lantern and was surprised to see the door half cracked ajar. She had no time to feel anger at Lord John for eavesdropping when the door swung fully open.
"Well, 'twas a gracious speech, ma'am," Sergeant Murchison said judiciously.
He smiled broadly then, and brought the butt of his musket up even with her belly.
"But I can't say I've finished quite with you."
She took a quick step back and swung the lantern at his head in a reflex of defence. He ducked with a yelp of alarm, and a grip of iron seized her wrist before she could dash the lamp at him again.
"Christ, that was close. You're fast, girl, if not quite so fast as the good sergeant."
Bonnet took the lantern from her and released her wrist. "You're not chained after all," she said stupidly, staring at him. Then her wits caught up with the situation, and she whirled, plunging for the door. Murchison shoved his musket in front of her, blocking her way, but not before she had seen the darkened corridor through the doorway, and the dim form sprawled face down on the bricks outside. "You've killed him," she whispered. Her lips were numb with shock, and a dread deeper than nausea sickened her to the bone. "Oh, God, you've killed him."
"Killed who?"
Bonnet held the lantern up, peering at the spill of butter-yellow hair blotched with blood.
"Who the hell is that?" "A busybody," Murchison snapped. "Harry, man, there's no time to waste. I've taken care of Hodgepile and the fuses are lit." "Wait."
Bonnet glanced from the sergeant to Brianna, frowning.
"There's no time, I said."
The sergeant brought up his gun and checked the priming.
Don't worry, no one will find them.
Brianna could smell the brimstone scent of the gunpowder in the priming pan. The sergeant swung the stock of the gun to his shoulder and turned toward her. But the quarters were too cramped. With her belly in the way, there was no room to raise the long muzzle. The sergeant grunted with irritation, reversed the gun, and raised it high to club her with the butt. Her hand was clenched around the barrel before she knew she had reached for it. Everything seemed to be moving very slowly. Murchison and Bonnet both standing frozen. She herself felt quite detached, as though she stood to one side, watching. She plucked the musket from Murchison's grip as though it were a broom straw, swung it high and smashed it down. The jolt of it vibrated up her arms into her body. Her whole body charged as though someone had thrown a switch and sent a white-hot current pulsing through her. She saw so clearly the man's face hanging drop-jawed in the air before her, eyes passing from astonishment through horror to the dullness of unconsciousness, so slowly that she saw the change. Had time to see the vivid colours in his face. A plum lip caught on a yellow tooth, half lifted in a sneer. Slow, tiny blossoms of brilliant red unfolding in a graceful curve across his temple. Japanese water flowers blooming on a field of fresh, bruised blue. She was entirely calm, no more than a conduit for the ancient savagery that men call motherhood, who mistake its tenderness for weakness. She saw her own hands, knuckles stark and tendons etched, felt the surge of power up her legs and back, through wrists and arms and shoulders, swung again, so slowly, it seemed so slowly. And yet the man was still falling, hadn't quite reached the floor when the gun butt struck again. A voice was calling her name. Dimly it penetrated through the crystal hum around her.
"Stop! For God's sake, woman! Brianna, stop!"
There were hands on her shoulders, dragging, shaking. She pulled free of the grip and turned, the gun still in her hand.
"Don't touch me," she said.
And he took a quick step back, his eyes filled with surprise and wariness. Perhaps a touch of fear? Afraid of her? Why would anyone be afraid of her? She thought dimly. He was talking. She saw his mouth moving, but she couldn't catch the words. It was just noise. The current in her was dying, making her dizzy. Then time readjusted itself, began to move normally again. Her muscles quivered, all their fibres turned to jelly. She set the stained butt of the gun against the floor to balance herself.
"What did you say?"
Impatience flickered across his face.
"I said it's no time we have to be wasting. Did you not hear your man saying that the fuses are lit?"
"What fuses? Why?"
She saw his eyes flick toward the door behind her. Before he could move, she stepped back into the doorway, bringing up the muzzle of the gun. He backed away from her instinctively, hitting the bench with the backs of his legs. He fell and struck the chains fastened to the wall. Empty manacles chimed against the brick. Shock was beginning to steal over her, but the memory of the white-hot current still burned through her spine, keeping her upright.
"You do not mean to kill me, surely?"
He tried to smile and failed, couldn't keep the panic from his eyes. She had said she would rest easier with him dead.
"Freedom is hard won, but is not the fruit of murder."
She had her hard-won freedom now, and wouldn't give it back to him.
"No,"
she said, and took a firmer hold on the gun, the butt snugged solidly into her shoulder.
"But I will, by God, shoot you through the knees and leave you here, if you don't tell me right this minute what the hell is going on."
He shifted his weight, big body hovering, pale eyes on her, judging. She blocked the door entirely, her bulk filling it from side to side. She saw the doubt in his posture, the shift of his shoulders as he thought to rush her, and cocked the gun with a single loud click. He stood 6 feet from the muzzle's end, too far to lunge and grab it from her, One move.
One pull of her trigger finger.
She couldn't miss, and he knew it. His shoulders slumped.
The warehouse above is laid with gunpowder and fuses, he said, speaking quick and sharp, anxious to get it done. I can't say how long, but it's going up with an almighty bang. For God's sake, let me out of here.
Why?
Her hands were sweating, but solid on the gun.
The baby stirred, a reminder that she had no time to waste either. She would risk 1 minute to know, though.
She had to know, with John Gray's body limp on the floor behind her.
You've killed a good man here, and I want to know why.
He made a gesture of frustration.
The smuggling, he said. We were partners, the sergeant and I. I'd bring him in cheap contraband. He'd stamp it with a crown's mark. He'd steal the licensed stuff. I'd sell it for a good price and split with him.
Keep talking.
He was nearly dancing with impatience.
A soldier, Hodgepile. He was onto it asking questions. Murchison couldn't say if he told anyone, but it wasn't wise to wait and see, not once I was taken.
The sergeant moved the last of the liquor from the warehouse, substituted barrels of turpentine, and laid the fuses.
It all goes up. No one can say it wasn't brandy burning, no evidence of theft. That's it, that's all. Now let me go.
All right.
She lowered the musket a few inches, but didn't yet uncock it. What about him? She nodded toward the fallen sergeant, who was beginning to snort and mumble. He stared at her blankly.
What about him?
Aren't you going to take him with you?
No.
He sidled to one side, looking for a way past her.
For Christ's sweet sake, woman, let me go and leave yourself.
There's 1,200 weight of pitch and turpentine overhead. It'll go off like a bomb.
But he's still alive. We can't leave him here. Bonnet gave her a look of sheer exasperation, then crossed the room in two strides. He bent, jerked the dagger from the sergeant's belt, and drew it hard across the fat throat just above the leather stock. A thick spray of blood soaked Bonnet's shirt and whipped against the wall.
There, he said, straightening up. He's not alive. Leave him.
He dropped the dagger, pushed her aside, and lunged out into the corridor. She could hear his footsteps going away, quick and ringing on the brick. Trembling all over with the shock of action and reaction, she stood still for a second, staring down at John Gray's body. Grief ripped through her, and her womb clenched hard. There was no pain, but every fibre had contracted. Her stomach bulged as though she'd swallowed a basketball. She felt breathless, unable to move.
No, she thought quite clearly to the child inside. I am not in labour. I absolutely, positively am not. I won't have it. Stay put. I haven't got time right now.
She took two steps down the black corridor, then stopped.
No, she had to check, at least make sure.
She turned back and knelt by John Gray's body. He had looked dead when she first saw him lying there, and still did. He hadn't moved or even twitched since she had first seen his body. She leaned forward but couldn't reach easily over the bulge of her belly. She grasped his arm instead and pulled at him, trying to turn him over. A small, fine-boned man, he was still heavy. His body tilted up, rolled boneless toward her, head lolling, and her heart sank anew, seeing his half-closed eyes and slack mouth. But she reached beneath the angle of his jaw, feeling frantically for a pulse point.
Where the hell was it?
She'd seen her mother do it in emergencies. Faster to find than a wrist pulse, she'd said. She couldn't find one. How long had it been? How long were the fuses set to burn? She wiped a fold of her cloak across her clammy face, trying to think. She looked back, judging the distance to the stairs. Jesus, could she risk it even alone? The thought of popping out into the warehouse above just as everything went off. She cast one look upward, then bent to her work and tried again, pushing his head far back. There! She could see the damn vein under his skin. That's where the pulse should be, shouldn't it? For a moment, she wasn't sure she felt it. It might only be the hammering of her own heart beating in her fingertips. But no, it was a different rhythm, faint and fluttering. He might be close to dead, but not quite.
Close, she muttered, but no cigar.
She felt too frightened to be greatly relieved. Now she'd have to get him out, too. She scrambled to her feet and reached down to get hold of his arms to drag him. But then she stopped, a memory of what she'd seen a moment before penetrating her panic. She turned and lumbered hastily back into the cell. Averting her eyes from the sodden red mound on the floor, she snatched up the lantern and brought it back to the corridor. She held it high, casting light on the low brick ceiling. Yes, she'd been right. The bricks curved up from the floor in groins, making arches all along both sides of the corridors, storage alcoves and cells. Above the groins, though, ran sturdy beams made of 8-inch pine. Over that, thick planking, and above the planks, the layer of bricks that formed the floor of the warehouse.
Going up like a bomb, Bonnet had said, but was he right?
Turpentine burned, so did pitch. Yes, they'd likely explode if they burned under pressure, but not like a bomb, no. Fuses in the plural. Long fuses, plainly, and likely running to small caches of gunpowder. That was the only true explosive Murchison would have. There were no high explosives now. So, the gunpowder would explode in several places and ignite the barrels nearby. But the barrels would burn slowly. She'd seen Sinclair make barrels like those. The stays were half an inch thick, watertight. She remembered the reek as they walked through the warehouse. Yes, Murchison would likely have opened the bungs of a few barrels, let the turpentine flow out to help the fire along. So the barrels would burn, but likely they wouldn't explode. Or if they did, not all at once. Her breathing eased a little, making calculations. Not a bomb. A string of firecrackers, maybe. So, she took a deep breath, as deep a breath as she could manage, with Osbert in the way. She put her hands across her stomach, feeling her racing heart begin to slow. Even if some of the barrels did explode, the force of the explosion would be out and up, through the thin plank walls and the roof. Very little force would be deflected down. And what was... She reached up a hand and pushed against a beam, reassuring herself of its strength. She sat down quite suddenly on the floor, skirts puffed out around her. "I think it will be all right," she whispered, not sure she was talking to John, to the baby, or to herself. She sat huddled for a moment, shaking with relief, then rolled awkwardly onto her knees again and began with fumbling fingers to administer first aid. She was still struggling to tear a strip from the hem of her petticoat when she heard the footsteps, coming fast, almost running. She turned sharply toward the stairs. But no, the footsteps came from the other way, behind her. She whirled around to see the form of Stephen Bonnet looming out of the darkness. "Run!" he shouted at her. "For Christ's sweet sake, why have you not gone?"
"Because it's safe here," she said.
She had laid the musket down on the floor beside Grey's body. She stooped and picked it up, lifted it to her shoulder. "Go away!" He stared at her, mouth half open in the gloom.
"Safe? Woman, you're an idiot. Did you not hear?"
"I heard.
But you're wrong. It's not going to explode. And if it did, it would still be safe down here."
"The hell it is! Sweet bleeding Jesus! Even if the cellar doesn't go, what happens when the fire burns through the floor?"
"It can't. It's brick."
She jerked her chin upward, not taking her eyes off him.
"Back here it is. Up front by the river it's wood, like the wharf. It'll burn through, then collapse. And what happens back here then, eh? Do you no good for the ceiling to hold when the smoke comes rolling back to smother you?"
She felt a wave of sickness roil up from her depths.
"It's open. The cellar isn't sealed. The other end of the corridor's open."
Knowing even as she spoke that of course it was. He had run that way, heading for the river, not for the stairs.
"Yes, now come."
He lunged forward, reaching for her arm, but she jerked away back against the wall, the muzzle of the gun trained on him.
I'm not going without him.
She licked dry lips, nodding at the floor.
The man's dead.
He's not. Pick him up.